This is David Wilk, host of Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm here today with Martin Melliver, the author of Living Above the Storm, published by Chelsea Green Press. Hi, Martin. How are you?
How are you, David?
I'm very well. You are, just to explain to our listeners, we're doing this call, this interview as a Skype call. You're in Israel, as I understand it.
That's correct.
I'm in the United States, so hopefully the technology works and we're able to have a conversation that other people can hear. I read Living Above the Storm very carefully. I found it to be a remarkable book. It's incredibly complicated and interesting on many, many levels. So it's going to be, my effort here is going to be to try to at least allow us to talk about some of the things in the book that I think are really exciting. Could you just give a brief summary of your background for the listening audience here? We have to assume has not read your book or doesn't know who you are. So if you could just talk a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book, that would be tremendous.
Sure, I'll try and do it very quickly. I grew up in Savannah, Georgia, part of a third-generation family business, Jewish family business, that started in the grocery store with my grandmother in 1940 in Savannah, Georgia, corner store. And my father joined us after college, ran it for 40 years, and then we sold the business in 1985. And when we sold the business, we discovered two things. One is that we had always been in the real estate business, only never realized it. We were building grocery stores and warehouses and offices, et cetera, for our grocery business. And the second thing we discovered is that we really didn't like real estate at all. And so when we sold the business in 1985, we were at a critical point as a third-generation family business, which is simply, do we sell out completely, get out of real estate, and invest in socially responsible mutual fund or something like that, or try and create a socially responsible real estate company? And we went that route, didn't know what it would look like, and still, I'd say even today, are still meditating or reflecting on how to leverage our business to create as little impact on the environment as possible and to maximize our positive impact on our community. So that's really the evolution of our business. I grew up in Savannah, Georgia, and grew up in that grocery store, and then took over the reins of running the real estate business in the early 90s. So I've been doing this for almost 20 years.
Well, I should have said at the beginning, the subtitle of the book is very important, I think. Building a business that creates value, inspires change, and restores land and community. And that subtitle hits, I think, on some of the key points or key elements of the book. And you tell lots of stories in the book about your family, about yourself. I think there's a process that you came to. It wasn't just that, you became a sustainable business by, kind of osmosis. It was a pretty long road that you traveled, I think, to get there.
It started really with my grandmother, and where, in probably not so atypical fashion, where you have a local business that's very much ingrained in the fabric of the community. So that the notion of what you do for a profession, a career, and where you live, and the people you engage with day to day, they're all intimately related to one another. As opposed to today, where you work one place, you live another place, you might play in a third place. I guess, when people ask us, how did you get into sustainable real estate, I would say in many ways it's part of the DNA of our family business of being very intimately involved in community. But you're right, it's been a very slow evolutionary iterative process of defining what it means to live more impactfully in every sense of the word and to conduct business in a more impactful sense. And that's something that's very, very critical for us today, as it was 20 years ago or 40 years ago, et cetera. So, you know, then every issue we deal with involves issues of value and how do we leverage a small business to create positive change, et cetera.
Well, and I think one thing I want to talk about is the notion of sustainability. You know, I think that it whenever terms are used in broad context, broad form in the mass media, it becomes the terms begin to lose their actual meaning. One of the things that I take from this book is the difficulty, the challenge to our embedded way of thinking about what business is, what our economic system is, about how we function as human beings, that when you start challenging those assumptions, what does sustainability mean? You know, is it possible for us to live in a growth economy? And is it possible to have a growth economy that's sustainable? I think, and you talk in very specific terms about Savannah and about your business, but I think a lot of what you say here is very challenging to people who would like to do something, who recognize that there is a serious problem and want to do something to change. You know, what you've presented is a very powerful document for that I think will help people understand what they need to do, but it is very challenging because you are, when you think deeply about what sustainability means, what community means, it forces you to change the way you look at how you function on a daily basis.
There's no question about it. And that's got so many pieces to it. I mean, for one, I think probably some of your listeners anyway probably know that our current carrying capacity is 1.25 planet Earths, meaning that how we source products and how we send our products into the waste stream, we need about a quarter more planet Earth today than we have. And if the emerging seven nations, China and India, Mexico, Turkey, Russia, et cetera, come online with the same level of consumption and affluence as the U.S., we're going to need somewhere 2 to 3 planet Earths. And if the rest of the globe follows suit, we need 5 planet Earths. So clearly, that's not sustainable. And that raises a whole host of questions and issues, as you point out. Ray Anderson, whom some of your listeners know, is the founder of Interface Carpet, likes to, you know, begin every one of his talks with the self-definition of himself as, you know, he's as competitive and as profit-seeking, a baron of industry as you will find. And I think that's probably true. I think if I had to, you know, talk about myself for 15 seconds, it would be, you probably would not find a more naive person stepping in to run a business 20 years ago than me. You know, I really believe that businesses were around to do good and that growth by itself was a good thing, and that governments were there to service the interests of people. And I think when you really begin to delve into issues of sustainability, you touch on so many aspects of our daily life, but I think what you touch upon most of all is a set of mythologies, a belief system, things that have been handed down to us, so we've sort of absorbed or believed things. Certainly, that I, you know, grew up believing, and it's taken, you know, 20 years of deep engagement with running a business to say, fast growth or even, you know, really strong growth is not necessarily going to be a good thing for all of us. I mean, if we're at 1.2 planet Earth's carrying capacity today and we're pushing growth, well, that's pushing us in the wrong direction. So you've got to begin to rethink that.
Right. Well, maybe what I sort of come to, and I'm not sure you said this, but it maybe what you said made me think this, that in fact its own development in that context is in fact redevelopment in a different direction. It's, you know, going, not to say going backwards, because I think that makes people think that we have to become different than we are in a negative way. And I look at it as we have to become different than we are in a positive way. but that in fact being a developer might mean redoing everything in a different way.
I think that comes. We haven't talked about this, David, but you've hit really on the vision of our company on a go-forward basis, which is, can we as a real estate development company continue to be profitable, get paid, for essentially not developing, or not developing in the way that traditional development is thought of? And I think the answer is yes, or at least it better be. And that business model, I think we're in the process of creating and shaping, but it means working with existing fabric, working with existing product, working in inner core, urban core areas, reworking existing fabric, embodied energy rather than building anew, and addressing real social needs as opposed to what the market necessarily says will work. You know, just because a specific community could sustain another hotel doesn't mean that that's necessarily a desirable product to deliver. So I think if we're focused on reworking existing fabric and addressing true social need, we're beginning to, I would say, rewrite the rule book for the way development works.
No, I think that's an important point. I think about that sometimes in other contexts that, for example, do we need any more manufacturing of clothes? There probably are enough clothes manufactured already to sustain almost all of us indefinitely, simply by reusing or repurposing. And you know, we all have the desire for new, so we don't want to wear the same clothes for 20 years. But you don't have to. You can take clothes from the past and redo them. And the same sort of idea, I think, applies to many other forms of business. And maybe development would be that way as well. That in fact, what we want to do is change the physical structure of our landscape back to more human and humane forms. And that's a form of development, but it's a kind of redevelopment rather than this kind of endless growth notion. We still can keep busy. We have plenty of work to do, but it's in redoing our infrastructure and our restructuring our economy so that it's not about building new products. And of course, you also touched on this, and I think this is clearly, to me, the most important issue, and that is finding a way to internalize what have been externalized costs.
Mm-hmm. And
I think that is the most challenging idea that I can think of in terms of economics and the way we think about business and growth, and very difficult on any level to do. And I think that you talk about that. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit now so we can get into that issue.
Sure. I mean, just for the general listener, I mean, basically what you're touching upon is a system in which, you create a political economy, a largely liberal economy of rights where, at least in the U.S., the rights of the corporation are synonymous or equivalent to the rights of an individual, and that allows corporations to do all sorts of things to our air, to our land, to our water, etc. And the true cost of doing business is externalized, simply, and that's an old Pigouvian concept from the British economist Arthur Pigou. And basically, virtually any company today, any kind of profit you see is a result of where the true costs are being borne by society at large and not by the company. And so the question is how do you create a different sort of economic system that accounts for the true cost? I think we're groping our way, at least in the carbon world. Certainly the legislation being debated now, carbon tax, cap and trade, is an effort to say, there is a cost to the emissions of carbon. Just in the same way that we addressed, ozone particulates that reduced our ozone layer. So, we're kind of crawling towards some notion, some rewriting of the economic rules for how costs are accounted for. And in the case of carbon, as you know, we're dealing with a very limited time frame and actually have to create a new set of rules.
Well, that's my biggest question is, how do we manage this? You know, we're crawling, but how much time do we really have before there are crises that we have to deal with that are greater, that we are not recognizing? I mean, I think in the greater scheme of things, it's probably true that the time horizons for climate change and energy have all been longer than most people thought that they would be. If you look at the environmental movement of the 1970s, the predictions then were, 25, 30 years from then, we would be in massive crisis. And now we're 25 or 30 years down the road, and we're not yet visibly in massive crisis. Some might argue that we are in crisis, we just don't see it. But in terms of the time frame, how do we deal with that? Because it is changing an embedded economy is a very difficult thing to do.
It is, and by token, it's also a necessity. I mean, if you look at, take a company like Royal Dutch Shell that really essentially in the 1970s created the notion of scenario planning. And basically what Royal Dutch Shell did was say, we're going to tell a story or two of the next 30 to 40 years looks like based on certain assumptions about what's going to happen out there. Political reality, the environmental reality, and based on those stories, one or two stories that we're going to tell, we're going to reshape our entire business strategy based on what we believe is coming down the pike. And Royal Dutch Shell had the vision to look and realize that peak oil was coming down the path and that the cheap oil prices that they were going to stay in effect. And basically began to rethink the way it does business. And really, I think any business of any worth and sensibility and sense of value creation over the long haul, any business today, has got to recognize that issues of water, energy, carbon, ozone, land, biodiversity, chemicals, toxins, marine life, forestry. I think, David, you would be hard pressed to find a business today that isn't significantly or maybe fundamentally impacted by one of those key environmental issues. And so the savvy business today, and it's sort of what I'm trying to move in my book, is to say the savvy business today, by necessity, has got to rethink its own business plan vis-a-vis critical environmental issues. Got to. Otherwise, it's not going to be around. And right. I think, anyway, go ahead.
Well, no, my question there is, and I completely agree with you, and I think the book is powerfully drawn to force us to recognize how important the changes are that we need to make and how we can actually do them, although you do make it very clear that it's a difficult process. And I guess this is my question then is, the individual business may be small, may feel that it can't by itself make the difference because the overall context of the economy, of the business system, is not friendly, if you will, to the changes that the company needs to make. So, obviously, I think most of us would agree that one of the issues one of the factors that you mentioned, if not all, affect every business. But then how do you reconcile the behavior of the business itself, the business owner, the people in the company? How do individuals and then small businesses or even large businesses make that difference within their own context when it's such a large-scale problem?
I'm grinning here because there's a famous comment that the founder of the body shop, Anita Roddick, once said, which I really love, is people who think that small things don't make a difference have never slept with a mosquito. and I love that on a lot of levels. I mean, we're a small business, clearly, operating in a very small town, you know, in a small part of the world. And our business mantra or model is simply pitch selection. You know, just, you know, think of some of the best hitters in all of baseball, and what they did best of all was to really select their pitches extremely well and strategically. And so we can't do every project in the world and wouldn't want to, but the key is to select projects that will leverage social change, and that we can demonstrate to the naysayers out there that this is actually doable, it's profitable, and in fact is, in a sense, an imperative. So, okay. That's our business model. You can say it's cute and it's small, it's boutique-y or whatever, I don't think it is. I mean, if you look, first of all, we've been approached by a number of some of the largest real companies globally, including GE. And, you know, GE has got this eco-imagination going, and, you know, so they've got this whole PR campaign. But, you know, they take down about $3 billion worth of real estate on an annual basis, and none of it is green. So they've, you know, their walk and talk are a bit out of balance, to understate things. And so you find one of the largest companies in the world, maybe the largest company in the world, talking to one of the smaller companies in the world saying, you know, we're interested in talking to you about how to make this happen. And while that kinds of conversations don't happen in our offices every day, they do happen periodically, and that's a good thing. I mean, we use our projects to change local ordinances and regional ordinances and state and beyond. So, I think we are not doing small businesses the service that we should. I mean, you think about what. Let's see, Stonyfield Farm, for instance, has done for organic dairy market, you know, picked up by Danone. But Danone hasn't messed with Stonyfield's business up, you know, business plan. They'd be fools, too. The same, I'd say, with Unilever and Ben & Jerry's, or, you know, the picking up of Tom's of Maine and, you know, Burt's Bees. You've got small businesses that are leveraging what they do, and it becomes so attractive that it's getting major play in some of the larger multinationals around the globe. So I think we do ourselves a disservice by kind of siloing small businesses in that sort of, you know, cute, you know, unique, somewhat idiosyncratic category. I mean, I've been there. I mean, I've been on, you know, the floors of New York Bankers where they say, well, you know, you should be on another floor talking to, you know, our mission-driven department. So we're very mission-driven. We're also profit-seeking as well. The two are not mutually exclusive. And, you know, I think there's a tremendous amount of power and influence leveraged properly.
Well, I think we might have to save that for another call, another conversation, because I would talk to you about then, and I think we will have another conversation about practical ways that we can make change and extend the message, some of the messages in your book, to as wide an audience as possible. I really want to thank you, Martin Meliver, for talking with me today about your book, Living Above the Store, Building a Business That Creates Value, Inspires Change, and Restores Land and Community. It's a book that has definitely inspired me, and I thank you for that. This is David Wilk for Writers Cast. Thanks again.